We've been looking at Daniel for 6 weeks now, the book of Daniel, and we are entering into strange territory. I heard one person call this the funky part of Daniel. I think Daniel's been pretty funky all along. You might remember Matt's phrase from a couple months ago calling Daniel a weird rodeo. We're entering into weird rodeo place, and that's because Daniel chapter 7, which we're looking at this morning, marks a hinge point in the book of Daniel. It is where we move from narratives about Daniel's life as a member of the Israel exilic community in Babylon to apocalyptic literature of the future. And apocalyptic literature can be a little hard for us. In fact, over the past several weeks, as we've been nearing studying this, I've had several people. If you think I'm talking about you, I want you to know I'm talking about many people who have come up to me and said, I don't know what to do with this. It's full of images. Some of it can feel pretty graphic and even overwhelming to look at. As you'll see in chapter 7, this vision that we're about to look at was overwhelming for Daniel. Some of it can feel violent, and it has strange beasts, and it's hard to understand. And my hope for you this morning is, and for the next several weeks as we make our way through the rest of Daniel, is that by reading this together and talking through this material, it might make it more accessible for all of us, that it would be a help to us as we read these things, that you might be able to read these if you can't already, that you might be able to read these and find these nourishing. And even more importantly, that you can find all the assurances that God offers his people through the apocalyptic literature of the Bible. Listen, some of the most wonderful assurances God gives his people is through visions like these. Whether it's here in Daniel, or whether it's in the book of Revelation, or whether it's the several mentions of what it will be like when Jesus returns in all glory that Paul leans on in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, that John leans on constantly. These things are given to us for our assurance. And the proposal, the argument that I want to make for you this morning is that this vision I'm about to read, Daniel chapter 7, was given for Daniel's assurance. That it was given for the assurance of all the Israelites in exile at the time, and that God had you in mind, that it's given for your assurance as well. Let's look together. This is Daniel chapter 7. I'm going to read all 28 verses, but have no fear. I'm not going to preach on all 28. I'm going to focus most of the preaching on the first half of the vision, but I think the whole thing is important to you. Hear the word of the Lord. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. And then as I looked, its wings were plucked off and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, 'Arise, devour much flesh.' After this, I looked, and behold, another like a leopard with 4 wings of a bird on its back, and the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. And after this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the 1st horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. And as I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. And I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all this, and he told me and made known to me the interpretation of the things. These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever and ever. And then I desired to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying, with his teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. And about the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn that came up, and before which 3 of them fell, the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things and that seemed greater than its companions. And as I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them until the Ancient of Days came, and the judgment was given for the saints of the Most High, and the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. And thus he said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms, and it shall devour the whole earth and trample it down and break it to pieces. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kingdoms shall arise, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones and shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and shall think to change the times and the law. And they shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and a half a time. But the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away, to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion of the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Here is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me, and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Let me pray. Lord, would you open our eyes that we might see great things? Would you open our ears that we might hear great things? Would you open our hearts that we might receive them and trust them? I pray this help for all of us here. I pray help for me, that you might help me to speak in a way that that is in fidelity to you. I pray that you'd speak, help me to speak in a way that does honor to this text. I pray that you'd help me to love these friends well, and that you would nourish all of us with hope in Jesus. And I ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. So it was somewhere in my first year of getting to know Shonda that I learned her father's favorite hymn. It was called "The Sands of Time Are Sinking." Now listen, when you're falling in love with somebody's daughter, this is important information to get a hold of and to hold on to. And at the time, I wasn't familiar with that hymn, hardly at all. And I didn't know many hymns at that time. Thankfully, Shonda has educated me pretty extensively on these things. But I remember thinking that the title for this hymn sounded pretty dour. "The sands of time are sinking. Time is passing. It's irretrievably passing. Nothing can stop it. It's all lost," is what I thought it was. And I just never thought it made sense that this could possibly be her father's favorite hymn until I looked. And I looked at the first verse, and it all started to make sense to me. "The sands of time are sinking, the dawn of heaven breaks. The summer morn I've sighed for, the fair sweet morn awakes. Dark, dark has been the midnight, but dayspring is at hand, and glory, glory dwelleth in Emmanuel's land. Song of assurance. It's a song that promises that the world to come will not disappoint. It's a song that is honest about the days in front of us. Dark, dark has been the midnight, but it holds great promise for the days that are to come. Glory, glory. I would propose to you that that is exactly what Daniel 7 is doing. Verses 1 through 8 are sobering. They're even chilling in a lot of ways. They speak of our need of assurance. That's what I want to say about these passages. Verses 1 through 8 speak to our need of assurance. And then verses 9 and following show us where assurance can be found. It holds great promise for the world to come. Our need of assurance and where assurance can be found. All right, first, let's talk about our need of assurance. Verse 1 gives us a time stamp. So this is in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Now, for a while, if you've been studying here for the past couple weeks, you'll know that this is actually a jump back in the narrative. So Daniel chapter 6 is set in a time when Darius the Mede is now the king that Daniel answers to. He's a Medo-Persian king. He took power in 539 B.C. This is the first year of Belshazzar's reign. He was a Babylonian king. This is 552 B.C. So you're stepping back in time a little bit, really, in the narrative between chapters 4 and 5. It would have been after Nebuchadnezzar was humbled and Belshazzar took rule. And then it would have been before the writing of the writing on the wall story in chapter 5. So it kind of steps back a little bit. And that's very important because of what we're about to see in this vision. That's when Daniel is given this vision. He sees a vision of the world's chaos, and he sees a vision of the people's distress. A vision of the world's chaos, a vision of the world's distress. Chaos leaps off the page immediately. In verse 2, you have a great clue. It talks about four winds getting stirred up over the great sea. In the Bible, the sea is often a symbol of chaos. It's where the uncontrollable and unpredictable forces exist. And this, in this case, it's the source of chaos. It produces chaos, and that four beasts are emerging from it. And the beast, now we don't get a lot of interpretation from the Bible itself, not specifically about what these beasts pertain to. There's a very short explanation in verse 17 that an angel gives to Daniel explaining this vision. But the natural, and the angel tells us that each one of these beasts pertains to a ruler that shall arise out of the land, a ruler to come. So it would be a king, a kingdom, a ruler being represented by each one of these four beasts. And that's really all we know. Now, there are times when there are beasts that that will be named, more specifically. Next week will be an example of that. I'm going to give you a theory, a view of what each of these beasts are, how they relate, but I'm going to ask you to hold it loosely. And the reason for that is, one, just epistemic humility, okay? There are people that I find this view very compelling. I think you probably will too. There are sensible people, educated people, studied people that disagree with this view, that take another view of it. But I also think that there is very large point being made about the nature of our world in verses 1 through 8 that I don't want us to lose sight of. So here's the view. The first beast. I think this beast is Babylon, present day Babylon. This is verse 4. It's a lion with eagle's wings. You've got ferocious, violent, powerful animals that rise up. The eagle's wings are plucked off. It began to look and act like a man. I think that is certainly resembling Nebuchadnezzar's humbling in chapter 4 when he was made to be beast-like and then his reason returned to him and he became like a man. This first beast is Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, okay? And then the second beast is in verse 5. Is like a bear. Again, another powerful animal. Daniel's probably seeing a Syrian bear, which were massive and strong and powerful that grew up. This beast is probably the Medo-Persian kingdom that would rise. Darius the Mede took control in chapter 6. That's what Daniel is seeing a future vision of. So the writing on the wall that he saw in chapter 5 probably wasn't a surprise to Daniel. That would have happened about 13 years after he received this vision. That's a powerful animal. It represents Medo-Persian nation that displaced Babylon. The three ribs in its mouth probably represent three rulers or three nations that they displaced before coming to power. If it's the three nations, it would have been Babylon, Lydia, and Egypt that Medo-Persian one by one took out in order to attain their place of power. The third beast is in verse 6. Now, that's a leopard. And it's a leopard with wings. Now that's interesting. A leopard is known for how fast they are. They move rapidly. They're very agile. And the wings probably draw more attention to the speed of the leopard. I think this is probably a reference to Alexander the Great. And if you're familiar with Alexander the Great, you know how rapidly he expanded his kingdom. In about 10 years, he conquered, just about all of the known world at the time. Yeah, I'm not going to try and recall the boundaries in my head. I had them at one point, but it took him about 10 years to do it. It was rapid expansion. He did it all before he was about 32 years old. And when he came to the end of it, he didn't know what else to conquer. He said, I don't know what else I can do with my life. And he died shortly after that. And when that happened, his kingdom was divided up. You see four heads in this passage. His kingdom was divided up and given to four different generals or leaders in his nation. So this seems to be predicting that very thing that would happen. And then you've got a fourth beast that arises, and this beast is terrifying. Now, it doesn't seem to look like any animal that we would know of or be able to remark on as meaning something. It just stands alone. What does Daniel call it? He says it's terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. You think this is probably the Roman Empire. That was unlike anything the world had ever known in terms of its power, its longevity, in terms of its influence, and the stories of oppression as it grew to its power are numerous and very difficult. It had 10 horns. What did horns mean? Usually in the Bible, horns represent power, and a beast would normally have two horns. So this is five times two horns, five pairs of horns. It represents a kind of totality of power in this empire. And from it, curiously, emerges a little horn. Now, this little horn doesn't stay little, but he shows up. He's got eyes, and he's got a mouth that just won't stop talking. What does it say? It says it keeps saying great things. It tells us that he is very arrogant. So he's very powerful. He displaced the horns that came before it. And he's also very arrogant. That's a terrible combination. Powerful and arrogant at the same time. He's bloviating. I love that word. A lot of people wonder what this little horn might mean. This little horn grabs Daniel's attention, as you can understand. And in verse 25, it says that he's speaking words against God and that he's wearing out the saints. He's wearing out God's people. This is a promise, or this is a prediction of future suffering and oppression for God's people by this little horn. Some people think that this might be the man of lawlessness that is mentioned in 2 Thessalonians 2. That's one theory. We can't know these things. Other people think that this might be one of the antichrists, future oppressor of God's people that John writes about. Some people think this is Antiochus Epiphanes, who was famous for his persecution of the Jews in the first and second century. I mean, just a terrible oppressor. We can't know what these things are for sure, or who this little horn is, but there's a point that's being made here that I want us to grab a hold of. If you pan back a little bit, what is Daniel seeing? One beast after another after another. One beast displacing the one that came before it. Seems like escalating chaos, it may be, but what he's seeing is a rhythm of chaos. He's seeing what one of my friends calls a depiction of the scope of the history of the world. This is just one of the ways the world works. So nations rage. Powerful people are vying for power. And all along the way, people suffer. One of the things this vision is assuring us of is that this world is no place to find a lasting peace. It is trying to protect us from attaching our hope of peace, to anything that belongs in this world. There may be peace for a time, but there's no lasting peace. There may be peace for some time and for some people, but it gets interrupted over and over and over again. Let me ask you a question. This is a hard truth. I mean, I think it requires a lot of thinking about for us, but let me ask you a question. Have you ever caught yourself asking the question, when will this ever end? When will this ever end? I find that the older I get, the more I'm asking that question. A few weeks ago, you all sent me to Crete. Thank you for that. You know, everybody here thought that was like a vacation, you know? It was great. I was glad to be there. Crete is beautiful. You could call it a peaceful place. But this was a time when I got to hear stories from missionary families. I was sent there to care for missionary families, especially missionary kids, and hear their stories of what life was like in different places of the world. And that was important. But while I was there, I just couldn't help but keep thinking, you know, there is a war that's about 1,000 miles north of here. It just entered its fifth year. But many people that are familiar with that conflict will tell you that this conflict spans generations. When will this end? And while I was there, I knew that about 600 miles to the west of me was, sorry, to the east of me was another war, another conflict. That many people will be quick to root it in generations of conflict, centuries of conflict. When will this end? When will this end? Unless we think, and I don't think you do, but unless we think the world's problems are somewhere else, it was just a few months ago, I was having breakfast with a friend of mine. He's a black pastor in the city. He's become a very good friend. And we sat and talked for a long time about how life has changed, how the pandemic, we think, has had lasting change on the way we do life together, it's had a lasting impact on the church and what our communities look like. And I listened to him talk for a while about just how the nature of racial reconciliation or the hope of racial reconciliation has been affected. And we kept asking the question, is it getting better? Has there been progress? What were we asking? Will this ever end? Will these things ever end? We ask that question when we look at the chaos of the world. We ask that question when we look at the things that plague our neighborhoods and our cities. We often ask that question when we think about our own lives. Will this sickness ever end? Will this pattern of an unhealthy relationship in my family ever end? Will the things that plague me, will this addiction ever end? Listen, I want you to hold on to those things as we move into verse 9, because verse 9, my friends, is a record scratch moment. I mean, it's like this interrupting vision that appears. And we have all of this need that we feel, honest need that we feel for assurance, and then it moves into a vision of the throne room of God that appears in verse 9. It's like he's saying, you need assurance? This is where you're going to find it. It's in verse 9, and there are many people that are mentioned in this passage, but there are multitudes being mentioned, even angelic attendants being referred to in this passage. But the two people that stand out as the source of our assurance, you see in verse 9 and verse 13. The first is the Ancient of Days. What is the Ancient of Days? And then in verse 13, you see this character called the Son of Man. What the heck is that? Who is the Son of Man? And so that's what I want to talk about. These are the people that provide the assurance of hope, that tell us that hope is not unreasonable for the Christian, even in the midst of these things, even when we ask that question, will this ever end? Verse 9. The Ancient of Days. Well, what does that mean? Well, the Ancient of Days is God himself. And you'll notice that this Ancient of Days is drawn in striking contrast to the empires and the rulers that came before him. You'll notice that each one of these beasts, even though they had power for a time, eventually their power disappeared, or they were overpowered by the next beast that is to come. But Ancient of Days, you see that his rule is from everlasting to everlasting. Ancient of Days actually means the eternal one. It is pointing to the long-standing rule of God himself, that he never surrenders and never runs out. Also, remember, these beasts, they're feverish in their activity, right? They rise and devouring, and it's just kind of gruesome when you look at it. They're bent on feeding themselves all the time. But in this passage, what we see in the Ancient of Days is that he's calm. What does it say? In verse 9, it says that he took his seat. That tells us that he sits on his throne in peace. He's not panicking. He knows where things are going. He's not worried for his rule. He's not worried for himself. He's not concerned about the welfare of his people. He knows he has them well in hand. It also tells us that he's a person of character. He can't be taken by surprise. He's a person of character. Remember this little horn has a scary combination of arrogance and great power. What you see in this passage is that this person has great character. That's what is being referred to by the clothing that's as white as snow. Excuse me. Clothing is white as snow, and his hair is like pure wool. He's someone that you can trust, and his judgment is perfect, and that's really good news because he's also keeping an account. You see that in verse 10? It says the books were opened. What books are these? Well, these are grounds for judgment. All of this comes in the context of a promised judgment that the Ancient of Days will bring. What you see in this passage is this promise of a future day that will come when God takes the history of the world. This is how I heard somebody put it. God is taking the history of the world into his hand and setting it to rights. And how does he do it? Well, he does it through this person that's being referenced in verse 13 called the Son of Man. Now, the Son of Man must mean that he is human. That's Son of Man must mean that he is human. Ezekiel refers to himself. Ezekiel was a prophet, but he was also just a man. Refers to himself several times as the Son of Man. But in this case, what you see in this vision is that the Son of Man is fully human, and he has divine qualities. You see, he comes in on the clouds. He's riding on the clouds. Well, that's significant in the Bible. The clouds often mean God's presence when you see a cloud in there. Remember the pillar of cloud that went before God's people. It was a promise of God's presence. The cloud that filled the temple when he filled it with the Spirit. The cloud that was on Mount Sinai when Moses went to meet with, Moses. Went to meet with God on the top of Mount Sinai. Listen, when Jesus was transfigured in glory on the top of a mount, a glory cloud showed up, one that they hadn't seen for centuries. Jesus, or the Son of Man, is seen as a cloud rider. Well, there's a promise in Isaiah 18:19 and Psalm 18 that God comes to the rescue of his people riding on a cloud. This is someone who belongs in the divine council, who's welcomed in God's presence. He has human qualities and he has divine qualities. Who could this Son of Man be? This is the one. This is the vision of the one that God is sending to rescue his people, to give his people a perfect and lasting peace and set the world to rights. Who is he talking about? Fully human and fully God. There's a scene in Mark chapter 14. This is the long night before Jesus' death. Jesus is standing before the high priest and the council, and people are giving false testimony about him. It says in the text very clearly that they were looking to kill him. But because they couldn't make all of these false testimonies agree with each other, they couldn't pass a sentence against him. And so finally, Caiaphas, the high priest, stands up and asks Jesus, "Are you the Christ?" And Jesus says to him, "Yes, but yes, I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." And as soon as he said that, Caiaphas tore his robes, accused him of blasphemy, and had all he needed to sentence him to death. This was the claim that Jesus made that got him sent to Pilate, who later sent him to the cross. Jesus, at the same time, confessed that he was the one that God sent and knew it would send him to his death. That these two things, far from being opposed to each other, actually agree with each other. That he was going to be the Son of Man who came to rescue his people, and he was going to be the one that God sent to die a sacrifice for his people. And there are many places, it's hard to sum up just all that the cross accomplished for God's people. But in Colossians 2, we're going to look at Colossians in the fall, but when you look at Colossians 2, you see Paul outline just one bullet point after another of all that Jesus accomplished for us on the cross. He says, by his shed blood, we have our peace. But he also said, by his shed blood, we stand forgiven before the Lord. Hold on to that. We stand forgiven before the Lord. That he does not pass judgment against us. And by his death, he disarms the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over us. What is he doing? He is telling us that by Jesus' death, and our being united to him by faith, he protects us from the book of judgment that you see in verse 10, and he protects us from fearing the lasting power of anything that you might be afraid of in verses 1 through 8. Jesus is the one who secures for us this peace that we long for. He's the one where we find our assurance. And it's interesting to me, over and over and over again, when Paul is writing to this young church in Thessalonica, these are young Christians who are being oppressed by the rule of an empire who hate that they're there. 7, possibly 8 times, depending on how you count it, Paul refers to the time that Jesus will return riding on the clouds in the air. He says, we will meet them in the sky. And then what does he say? Therefore, encourage each other with these words. This is the encouraging assurance that Paul is giving to us in 1 Thessalonians, that God is giving to Daniel and is being given to us in this vision. You know, I can't think of a modern piece of apocalyptic literature that promises good things to come. Like, seriously, they're all asking the question, is it possible for human decency and morality to survive in the world to come? Pick your poison. Mad Max is asking that question. The Book of Eli. Pick your zombie movie. They're all asking that question. Is it possible for humans to be decent in the world to come? What fills our imagination as we consider the world to come? We imagine a world ruled by a perfect human, fully man and fully God, with saints, his loved ones, who are made perfect by his sacrifice. The sands of time are sinking. The dawn of heaven breaks. The summer morn I've sighed for, the fair sweet morn awakes. Dark has been the midnight. But day spring is at hand, and glory, glory dwelleth in Emmanuel's land. Let me pray. O you, with all joy and with all peace, the one who sits on his throne right now and is not worried. I pray that you would give us this kind of assurance, this kind of fearless hope that you invite us to. Help us to envision a time when the whole world is united under your rule. Would you give us that great hope? I pray. In Jesus' name, amen.